the whole mechanism of ACS governance as a whole, and the fact that you thought the number of committees could be substantially reduced and still accomplish the same.
I'm sure that's still true.
These are obviously very strong viewpoints. I was wondering, in addition to the people who were on the side you were looking at, what kind of response did you get from your colleagues on these two areas?
Well, I think that my colleagues, if you're talking about colleagues that I come in contact with other than people who are ACS active, were very supportive. Gee, that's a great idea. That's wonderful. That's my dues. And we don't have to have all those committees. That's wonderful. So I think that, but that's the group that's the silent group that never really expresses themselves or get involved. Sometimes they don't even bother to take time to vote for president elect and people on the board of directors. Those people were supportive, and those people seemed to be sympathetic with what I was saying. But the minute I started talking to people who were in the governance of the ACS and had been for 20, 30 years or whatever, they couldn't appreciate at all what I was saying. But it was so obvious to me that there are committees that are absolutely necessary. I mean, you know, the Chemical Abstract Committee, the Public Relations Committee, the Education, you know, there are all sorts of committees that are absolutely necessary, and people are doing a good job. I'm not faulting all that. But there are committees that are set up, and they're maybe they were necessary when they were set up, but they don't go away. And they're struggling to keep themselves busy and to justify their existence, some of them. And that's ridiculous. I mean, and not only are there too many committees, but all these committees have a tendency to then set up task forces, you know, this, that, and the other. So they compound one another and so forth and so on. I'm sure you can get rid of half of those committees and task force and so forth, and the ACS would be properly governed. The governance and everything else would be as run smoothly as it does.
Have you seen much of a change, or any change in the last 7 years?
When I was finished after my third year as because you're president-elect president. And on the board of directors during those 2 years, and then you have one more year as a member of board of directors. At the end of that third year, I asked to be taken off of all the committees that I was on, because I wanted to, at least if I'd gone around talking the way I did and wanting to make room for other people to get on, I wanted to at least do the right thing, and I did. And I haven't really darkened their door since then. I haven't even gone to very many national meetings since then. I should really go to this one, because Harry Gray is getting the Priestley Award, and I just feel badly, but I have another commitment, which I'll be in Mexico for 2 weeks, and this was arranged before I even paid attention to when this national meeting is. There's so damn many meetings, you know, but I've got to be at this Congress in Inorganic Chemistry. I'm giving the opening plenary lecture in Mexico City, and then the people wanted me to, because I'd never been to Mexico before, and they wanted me to visit and give a lecture tour at various universities. And so they've got it all set up, and it conflicts with the national meeting, so I'm not going to even be able to go this time that I really wanted to go. So I haven't really been to very many of them. I don't know what's going on in terms of the governance and the like.
What would you say? Well, there was another area that you were also vocal about, and that was the academic-industrial interface.
Yes, I've always felt strongly, and my colleagues here can tell you as well, that we should have a closer interface, and we should get the two to work together much more so, and make a real effort in that direction. But it's always, it's been a very difficult thing. When I became chairman here, one of the first things I tried, this was 69-70, academic year 69-70, Henry Tabe and I had been on the NIH panel together, and we'd go out to dinner after one of our sessions, say, for example, and he was very enthusiastic about their industrial affiliates. And one reason was, of course, that it was a nice, lucrative thing for the department because the industries, in order to be members, would pay so much a year. But more than that, according to him, it brought into the department an educational aspect that was not there before. It would bring people from industry there, you know, who would give talks and so forth, and so that this was the kind of thing that students just never had access to before, and he thought this was very good. And so it just strengthened my feeling that when I became chairman, I did everything I could to try to get something like that started. Of course, this was an ongoing thing and had been at MIT and had been at Caltech for years and still is. But that was during the Vietnam situation, students protesting, and it was kind of a recession period and so forth. And it never got off the ground. I still blame my colleagues for not being supportive. Their argument was, gee, if we tried now, Fred, and we failed at make it more difficult later. But I think if we had tried, we would have been ahead of the pack, and we probably would be better off. We do have one now, but everybody else has one now. It doesn't mean much. What I did salvage from that was the Charles D. Heard lectures. Did he give you a pamphlet on his lecture?
Yes, that was part of the information he gave me here.
Yeah, that came out of my trying to do something, so that I almost unilaterally insisted that at least we ought to bring somebody here for 3 days. And we've been very successful. That's been very good. And Charles was a logical guy. He was a senior person. He had a lot of consulting experience with industry and so forth. So I was able to salvage it to that extent. In the ACS, I guess I was a little concerned at one point and disappointed that this happened. You know, the National Research Council, or what is it called? It's a Council for Chemical Research.
Yes, CCR.
CCR, Council for Chemical Research. When they started that, I read all the things that they put out, and universities and so forth should become members, and you get so much money for each PhD, and chemical engineers would get a little bit more, but they get so much money. And it just didn't make any sense to me, because it seemed to me that these industries that were going to be asked to join and give the money, which would then be passed on, they would prefer to deal directly with the departments that they themselves would like to be supported of. They wouldn't like to put their money in a pot and let somebody else decide what to do with it and everything else. So I felt a little bad. I was a little negative about that, even though that had to do with industry, and I might have said something to that effect. But I don't know how successful that's been. I guess it has not. It's still in existence.
Yeah,
I know. And I think that our department is still a member. I think, you know, you almost cannot be a member of that. You almost have to be in self-defense. But it does bring industry and academic people together, and to that extent, I think it's worthwhile. And the other thing I worried about is that it would set up another bureaucratic bunch of people, staff and otherwise, and consume a lot more time and energy. And why, you know, if there was something of that sort that could be done, why couldn't it be done through PRF or something in the ACS? But anyway.
What would you say that during that time that you were at the top office of ACS was your greatest achievement and your greatest frustration?
Well, you've already heard my greatest frustrations. What I thought was worthwhile, whether it was or not, because you can never really assess these things, was on those occasions when I was called upon to represent the chemist, American Chemical Society, whether it be on the Hill in Washington or in front of a TV tube or something. I thought that gave me an opportunity to try to make the point that chemistry is doing and has done and will continue to do a great deal for mankind. And I know we are all saying that to ourselves. We're all of us are convinced that that's true. We know it's true, but we're always like preaching to the choir, you know, what the hell, it's pointless. But at least this gave me a chance, not just to preach to the choir. I remember the very first time this happened. It was, I think in 83, was the 250th anniversary of Priestley's birth or something like that, and it must have been in January, in February or something, because I'd just become president of the ACS, and so I had to go to his Cumberland home, you know, in Pennsylvania. And the postmaster, they had issued a special stamp.
Oh, yes.
And one of the postmaster people was there, and somebody from the Unitarian Church was there because he had been very much involved in that. And it was a beautiful day, and we were looking at the house and everything that's there as a national museum kind of thing. And then those of us who were given about 5 minutes to say something got up on the podium. We were all sitting there. It was obviously pretty soon I was going to have to say something. And what I had decided to say was how Priestley was very important in discovering of oxygen, which turned out to be really the beginning of chemistry as we know it, and so forth. But most of the people out there were not chemists. Chemists didn't bother to come. They were theologians. I mean, they were Unitarians and church people and this, that, and the others. And they must have had about 100 people. I don't know, maybe less, maybe 70 or 80 people. But then anyway, there they were. And before it got to me, I decided, damn it, I'll just tell them that if Priestley were here now, he'd be proud to have been a chemist, because chemistry has done so much. He'd be pleased and as punched to see what chemistry has accomplished over all these years and what it is accomplishing. And I used as a vehicle, you know, energy and agriculture and medicine and so forth, pointed out that you're all of us trust our physicians and medical doctor, and if they diagnose the ailment properly and give us the right medication, things improve. But the person that really makes these wonder drugs, whatever they happen to be, usually are research people in the laboratories, biochemists or what have you, and not the physician who does the diagnosis and prescribes the medicine and so forth. Just those kinds of, just off the cuff kind of thing. After it was over with, we had some goodies and a little social hour, and the group was breaking up, and two or three of the older Unitarian fellows came up to me and they said, "Gee, sure glad you're here and were able to say what you did. We're surprised. First of all, we're surprised to see anybody here from American Chemical Society. We knew that Priestley was a chemist, but we thought people who were chemists these days weren't making public appearances." Because according to them, all of chemistry, and that wasn't true in those days, it's still true to a great extent, but in those days, dioxin and PCBs and all those things, you know, it was either toxic, carcinogen, or what have you. And so they were glad I had come along to represent the American Chemical Society and to make a point of all that chemistry has actually accomplished during all these years. So I think it was that. It was being on the Hill a few times to speak and support of education and science research and all those things. And as I say, you never know how much good it does. But at least you have a feeling, you come away that you're not just talking to other chemists.
Were you involved at all with funding for the center?
Funding for the center. Center.
The Beckman Center.
The Beckman Center. Yes, I was involved, at least, you know, before it was even, at the time that it was just called the ACS, I guess. And my very first meeting, I think I told you at the beginning, I was not an official anything. I was not on the board of directors. I think it was a board of directors meeting that was being held in November or December, and I became a member of the board and president-elect in January, on January the 1st. So they had asked me to come to this board meeting just as an observer. I didn't have a vote, I didn't have anything, but I was observing. And the board of directors had met one or two things. It's usually about a two-day session, and there are lots of things that are discussed and voted on and so forth. And I sat through all this because I felt that's the reason I came, and I wanted to sit through and see what the problems were, what things were being discussed, and so forth. Well, finally, at some point, Arnold Thackeray made his presentation, and then there was some discussion about whether the ACS should come through with however much it was, 50,000. And then it was opened up for comments, and even though I probably shouldn't have made a comment, I did make a comment. And the comment was that, gee, after sitting through this last couple of days of discussions, this is the first thing I really heard that's worth talking about. It sounds like it's something that really needs attention, and it would be a wonderful thing if the ACS could come up with the funding and be supportive of this. And of course they did, and then they got the other organization that involves the engineers.
Oh, AICHE.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So at least initially, to that extent at least, I was involved, which was no involvement at all other than just making a cup. But I was actually put on the advisory board for a few years, because if you look at some of those original chalks that used to come through, I think my name was there because I was president of the ACS.
There's another area which you were also very vocal about 10 years ago. And that has to do with the teaching of inorganic chemistry and where it should be and what general chemistry should be like and so on. I'd like you to comment on that, but did you continue to teach any general chemistry?
Oh, yeah, I insisted on teaching.
Okay.
We're on a quarter system, and the general chemistry is taught for 1 year for the regular group. The honors people only have two quarters, but the regular group have three quarters. And I have, all the years that I've been here, really, except the first two or three years, have always insisted on teaching one of those three quarters. Even when I was president of the ACS, I managed to do that. And I've enjoyed doing it, and I think that the students, student evaluations speak for themselves. Students are very enthusiastic about the course that I teach. I use a lot of lecture demonstrations. I teach, as I say, I teach reactions and syntheses. I use trends in the periodic table. I point out the certain kinds of classifications which allow you to make educated guesses, and I point out to them that if they look at the forest instead of the individual trees, this is a pine forest, that's an oak forest, don't worry about the trees, they'll take care of themselves. You don't have to memorize any reactions, not a one, because any reaction I give you in lecture or on the homework, I'll never ask on an exam, so don't bother. But learn how to learn the classification that I give, and then from that, and use of trends in the periodic table, you should be able to make educated guesses and be right 90% of the time. And if you're right 90% of the time in this class, you get an A, and that's the highest grade you can get anyway. And you know, some of those kids, the better ones, of course, some of them are totally lost, and I don't know that anybody could do much for them. But some of the better ones really do catch on, even more so than some of the graduate student TAs who are helping grade the midterms and everything. The graduate student TAs haven't really come to grips with having to learn some of these things in the same sense, and so there are some times during our grading that it's obvious that students know more than the graders. So anyway, I have been outspoken. I have written articles in Journal of Chemical Education and pointed out that I think that we've gone too far. I think that in general chemistry and teaching, first of all, at one point we were teaching only bonding. You know, people knew all about bonding this and bonding that, and rabbit ears this and orbitals that, and they didn't know whether sulfuric acid was a solid, liquid, or a gas, but they sure as hell knew that the sulfate ion is a tetrahedral type orbital hybrid of this type or the other. And then teaching baby physical chemistry, which is kind of pointless. If you're going to teach physical chemistry, why don't you let the physical chemists teach it later on? But it turns out, of course, that a lot of general chemistry is taught by physical chemists, and they feel more comfortable teaching baby physical chemistry than they feel teaching reactions and things. So yes, I have been rather outspoken, and I do think that part of our problem is, in part at least, the fact that we're not teaching enough reactions and things at that level. For those kind of people, might excite somebody. I mean, you know, you see colors change, you see precipitates form, you hear an explosion now and then, or whatever. If you blow up a hydrogen balloon by itself and then blow it up with a mixture of oxygen and hydrogen, you know, you can wake up the class.
Yes. It's true.
And so forth. So students take three quarters, and year in and year out, over all these years, my quarter always got the highest top rating, of course, and I think it's partly because of what the course content.
Mm-hmm. Use a text?
Yes. You can't follow it very much because texts aren't approaching this in much the same way, but fortunately now. And I think most of the authors even admit that they read this article that Bob Perry and I wrote. I actually wrote it, and I got Bob Perry to put his name on it, hoping that they'd pay a little more attention. And he agreed with it, so that was fine. Now I noticed that in revision of some of the texts, and some of the texts are doing a little more of this now than they had in the past. But it's still difficult because people that are teaching these things are people who have not learned that kind of chemistry in that manner, and they really are oftentimes physical chemists who feel much more comfortable with the physical chemistry and principles and solving problems and so forth.
I was intrigued, I think it may be in that article with Perry, the way in which you classify mechanisms as a way of making predictions, not stating the question very well, but for example, when I used to teach some organic chemistry to nursing students, I always point out you have a reactive site molecule. If you know what this does in general, it doesn't make any difference what else is around it, you can
sure.
make a prediction about
sure.
it. And
that's a nice thing about organic. That's why it's always been so much easier to mm-hmm. teach organic chemistry, because you can make esters. Doesn't matter whether you're making it on a huge molecule
right.
or a small one and so forth.
But weren't you, in essence, trying to relate the teaching of inorganic in a similar fashion? No, you can't classify it as neatly as you can in organic.
Sure, and I did it in a very crude, pedestrian way in terms of using language that's everyday language. For example, combination. There's a whole pile of reactions that are combination reactions. if you take a metal and you add oxygen to it, you make the metal oxide, and then you can talk about some metals being more reactive than others and so forth. And the noble metals, that they wouldn't react, and that's why you have platinum jewelry and so and gold jewelry and so forth. And then after you get combination, then you do decomposition, and you explain to them that there's certain kinds of things that will decompose when you heat them. I mean, if it's just an ordinary water hydrate, like barium chloride, octahydrate, and you heat it, probably you just drive off the water and you make anhydrous barium chloride. But then you can also tell them that if it's aluminum trichloride, hexahydrate, and you heat it, you sure as hell don't get anhydrous aluminum trichloride. You get aluminum oxide, and then you could explain to them about size and charge a little bit, you know, at the level at which these people can grasp. And it is a classification that is not very sophisticated, but it is a classification that these kids can understand and use. And the better students end up, as I say to them, by the time we're finished, you ought to be able to write thousands of equations without having memorized a single one of them. And some of them can.
Well, I know in the last years I was teaching, I was amazed at what students could memorize. Oh, God. Just incredible what they could memorize.
Well, that's it, but that turns them off, you know, if you have to memorize things.
Sure. But I found many of them didn't really I know it was a product of their earlier training, but they had no concept of studying any other way
but
by memorizing. Yeah.
But you know, if you give a lot of these inorganic reactions and so forth, and it's just reaction, and it makes no sense, and they can't tie it together in any way, there's nothing more deadly than that. That's the way general chemistry used to be taught.
Exactly.
And that was not the right way to teach it either, of course. But I think you can do a better job than that. Look, we're going to have to go upstairs if we can wind it up. How much more do you want to ask?
Well, I mean, I've skipped over some things, but you have covered your a lot of your scientific work and some of these other publications.
Yeah, you have a lot of information. So
I was trying to go behind the scenes and get some other information out, which
I
appreciate very much. And say thank you for spending the morning with me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I appreciate your dropping by, and Del Thackeray, I'm glad that he put me on the list, and that we have more people here if you ever need more. Everybody gets older all the time, and I'm not even the oldest, you know. Heard and Pines and so forth. Sure.